Mic session number 11281, reel 13.
Mr. Kelly, reel 13.
So I kept popping these bombs down, and it was going off very well. And then suddenly it stopped. And I dropped one down. I knew I dropped one down. And nothing happened. So I said to the officer, it hasn't gone off. He said, it has. Yeah, he said, you don't realise, he said, it's gone off. He said, it has gone off. He said, drop another one down. I said, it hasn't gone off. I said, I'm not putting another one down. So I was peering down the barrel. So he said, don't look down the barrel like that. He said, it might go off any second. He said, knock your head off. I said, well, how am I going to get it out? I said, what do you do now? He said, we have to wait now. So he told Captain Stevens, and he gave us a prescribed time to wait. I said, now what happens now? He said, well, you take it out now. I said, well, how do you take it out? I said, I'll never get my hand down there. So he said, no, he said, you tip it up. I said, tip it up? I said, it took 3 of us to carry it over here. I said, you want me to tip it up? Anyway, there's a little bit of a confrontation like that took place. And eventually he explained that you turn the barrel, slacken it off at the top, turn the barrel, and like a ball joint at the bottom, flattened on two sides, and it slides out. So I slid it out, and he said, right. I said, well, what's happening? I said, what do you want me to do now? He said, lift the bottom up. He said, the bomb would slide out the front. I said, but what happens when it slides out? So he said, well, you catch it when it comes out the end. I said, how can I catch it? I said, if I'm at this end, lifting it up, I said, and it comes out that end, how am I going to catch it? I said, and what happens if I don't catch it? So he said, all right then. He said, I'll hold this end. So I said, where am I? He said, you get to the front. Oh, I said, I thought so. So it went on like that. Well, that happened about 4 or 5 times. And eventually I said, well, I'm having no more to do with that. I said, that thing's rubbish. I said, no wonder the Germans left us or discarded us. I said, the damn thing's no good. So he said, it must be all there. He said, they must have done a lot of firing with us. He said, it's full of rubbish at the bottom, he says. So I said, well, that's no consolation to me. I said, I'm not firing anymore. Anyway, Captain Stevens has aborted the idea anymore. He said, in the safety of all our own people, he said, you better wrap it up. So we packed it up. And then he had the idea of taking there was an artillery unit, Vitakak, with Beaufort's guns, and they, was the thing I was telling you about. And he decided that perhaps the artillery would like to have a go and let us get some of our own back. So they did, they agreed to take this Beaufort's down on its track. And we took it down the road as far as we could while it was dark, turned it round. And then as soon as it came light, these gunners hopped up on their little perches on the side of it, on the trailer, and opened up with his Beaufort's. And they just set fire to one house where the Germans were. It was a great sight to see these Beaufort's, this Beaufort lashing away at the Germans. They must have wondered what was happening. As soon as we heard the pop-pop of them retaliating with their mortars, we had to get them out, and the artillery did shift out a bit smartish. So there was no casualties, but it was a very, very heartening thing to us, and it gave us the feeling at least that we were getting some of our own back. And then, of course, it came about that Le Havre packed up and we went required anymore there. So we moved off to Brussels, although we didn't know we were going there, but we ended up in Brussels after being transported there by the RASC. And we stayed the night in Brussels in a large building which slept on the floors, just on a blanket. And I think we were only there for one night. And the next day, there's a huge convoy of vehicles came along, and we were boarded, ordered into them. All our gear was thrown in. And we went to a place called De Haan. near Zeebrugge in Belgium. So that meant that we'd covered right through France and into Belgium now. And we were taken to this place in Dihan, and right up, it was more like a resort actually, a seaside resort, Dihan. And there were these large hotels on the seafront. And the German defences there were very extensive. There was huge bunkers and great big guns pointing at them. And some of them didn't have guns in them, actually. But they looked as though they could be run in from the back and used at any time.
You said this is near Zeebrugge?
Just outside Zeebrugge, this Dihan was the actual name of the place. And they had these huge flamethrowers parked in between that operated from the bunkers and squirted in between the bunkers towards one another. It's like a crossfire in between the gaps in these huge bunkers. And they were enormous bunkers, enormous size. And they were in depth as well as being spread right along the coastline. And we were using the entire coastline before we'd finished as a training area. But when we first arrived there, of course, it was billets that we wanted. And we headed for these empty hotels. But when we got there, we were quickly stalled, and with good reason, by engineers who said that they were booby-trapped, or be very careful of the booby-traps. And at that time, the booby-traps had become a little bit of a naughty business, because they were used in all sorts of ways. Dead men were booby-trapped. Things that were likely to be souvenirs were booby-trapped. And toilets were booby-trapped. And the luxury of sitting on a toilet, could override somebody's caution. Or they may not even think about it. But when they came to flush the toilet, they would activate the booby-trap. Or even if they sat on the seat, was enough to detonate some of them. So it had to be, we had to go over it with a fine-tooth comb, and you couldn't take any precaution. You had to take every precaution, and you couldn't even say, because the door was partly open, that it would be safe to open it and go in, because that it might just be designed partly open. Shutters on the windows, where all the windows had the shutters closed over, probably for the duration of the war, shutters were booby trap. And we did have two or three casualties through the booby traps until we finally cleared the hotel, at least the hotel that we were in. And we took over this hotel, Beach Hotel it was called, actually. And I've seen it since. I've been actually on holiday close by it. And still there, or was. So we made our billet in this hotel, and it was quite comfortable. There was lots of bedding around, and palliasses and things like this, and where you could make yourself comfortable, and it was quite nice. So it made a change to living out in the field all the time, and it was the first time that, in actual fact, that we'd been in close proximity to civilians. And it was the first time we could walk in. The first time, in actual fact, we walked across the road from the hotel and could go into a cafe and a beer hall and have a beer and spend money. And that was the first opportunity that we'd had since landing. So it was quite a thing as far as we were concerned, and quite a relief to get away from holes in the ground and the smell of earth. But of course the training started again then, and there was lots of firing and lots of throwing 36 grenades, and especially into these apertures of these bunkers, because they were ready-made targets and actual type of targets. So it was very good for training. And we learned to throw the 36 grenade like a cricket ball instead of lobbing it like a 1914 soldier. So we were throwing them into and lobbing them with a certain amount of accuracy as well towards the end. And as I say, a lot of firing and a lot of physical training came into it. as well. And we did one or two exercises along the dikes, which was probably training for where we were going, but we didn't realise it, of course, at the time. And a comic situation that happened there. Nutty Sherman was the two-inch mortar man, really, and it's always been his bent. And he was operating the two-inch mortar on this particular little exercise that we were doing. And we were only firing smoke, although you could fire HE with the two-inch mortar. On this particular occasion, we were only using smoke, and we only intended to use smoke because it was smoke screens that we'd more likely to be require than for our little two-inch mortar bombs to have any effect on the concrete pillboxes that we were likely to be attacking. So the smoke would be most useful. And you can imagine a countryside devoid of anything, dead flat, and stuck up in one little corner of this thing, of this flat field. And it was quite a long way, you know. A quarter of a mile at least or more. And there was this haystack. Now, it was the conventional type of haystack, the round one with the sloping things on the top, like a roof on the top. And this haystack was standing there by itself, completely and utterly alone. And it was the only aiming mark that Nutty Sherman had. And when they, all that, as a two-inch mortarman, all that he would be looking for, actually, was the direction of the wind. So that he could throw his bombs into the wind, and the wind would carry it across the target, either left or right. Or if the wind was behind us, they'd drop it in front of the target so that it blew onto the target. And similarly, if it was blowing towards us, he'd drop it behind the target so that it blew across and around the target and give as much cover as possible. But it wasn't supposed to be accurate. You could be 100 yards off and have the desired effect. 100 yards off the target, right or left, and have the desired effect for what you wanted for. Because the smoke is quite thick on a two-inch mortar bomb, you know, when it went off correctly. So you didn't have to be that accurate. And when I say that, you know, you can imagine this clear open space with just this one little obstacle standing up. And when it was used as an aiming point, or when it was used as a reference point, to be more precise, the enemy fire was supposed to come from the area of the haystack. And Nutty Sherman would, be required to smoke it out. So he fired, and he hit it smack in the middle, the haystack. It was one shot in thousands, and he set fire to it. And he burnt it out, and it destroyed the complete exercise, because the farmer came racing out. He ignored the fact that we were soldiers with loaded guns, completely disregarded the fact that we could have shot him or anything of that nature, came storming out and demanded to know why we had destroyed his haystack, and why all the things that we could do during a war, and the buildings and everything else that we could destroy perfectly legitimately, we had to go and pick on his little peaceful haystack. It went on for hours, this shouting and bawling by the farmer. And he was joined by his family, his wife, and other people, all remonstrating with Captain Stevens. And Captain Stevens, I remember saying to Nutty Sherman, you know, why did you have to hit it? And Nutty Sherman said, well, I didn't actually aim at it. He said, it was just, just a normal thing. He said, I was just surprised if anybody else said when it was on fire. So that put paid to that exercise. And
did he get compensation?
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, that's what he was after, compensation. Oh, yes. Yeah, well, he would be compensated for that. But that, there was limited to what you could do in the way of exercises, because what we didn't know is that we'd be fighting on sand hills all the time. So we did a lot of training in the sandhills, of course, you know, along the coast. But it was limited to what you could do because it was already mined by the Germans and hadn't been cleared, you see. And they weren't going to use the manpower of the engineers to clear the mines at that time. They'd leave it until a more peaceful time when things had quieted down a bit. So as we still had to get a port, the object of our training there was to take the island of Walcheren. And the island of Walcheren had been fortified by the Germans to such an extent that it was a miniature fortress. And it blocked the route that ships would have to take up to the port of Antwerp. So it was the job of our brigade to knock it out. So, as far as we were concerned, and it was a seaborne landing on this little island. Now, one of the features about this particular thing is that because there was a little bit of a worry, I'm not saying a worry in our brigade about this, but there was a general, I think, misunderstanding about Arnhem going around at the time. Because Arnhem had just taken place. Or it had taken place very, you know, in close proximity to the time we were in Dijon, if I remember rightly. And I remember that we were told that our operation would be successful and they would not attempt another Arnhem. And that's the way it was put to us. So we were briefed then about the island itself, and we were told that the only place we would be landing at would be the gap that was blown in the dike by the RAF, or would be blown in the dike by the RAF, and that would flood the inlands, and we would be virtually fighting on the rim of a saucer. That's the way they described it. But to put it in a more realistic picture, if you were think of the sand dunes that you see around the coast, especially outside Liverpool in the Southport, Formby Way, where there are sand dunes right by that's the type of picture you get of Walcheren, except that the sea side of the sand dunes was normally a man-made structure, like bricks, huge bricks or stones, things like that, and then you had a shelving beach to the water. So it was expected that we would land directly into the gap and spill out and move left and right around the island. Now, it's going to the left as you look at the landing point from the sea. 4-1 commander would go to the left, and that's they would clear the objectives to the left and go around that way. 48 and 47 commandos would turn right and head down the sand hills in the opposite direction to 4-1, and they would join up with number 4 commando, who would land in the area of Flushing. So that was basically the plan. Now the individual briefings that the troops got meant that a troop were to capture the lighthouse and to capture the village of West Capel, which was almost right on the gap. And we were to clear the enemy pillboxes and things like that around there, and to take possession of this tall building at the end, which didn't really look like a lighthouse, but they'd say it was, but so we accept that. It's a big tall building like a lighthouse. And that was our objective, and to make sure that was clear, because they suspected that being used quite obviously as an observation post for the German artillery. Now, as they expected the island to be ringed with guns, which it was, there were batteries placed all around, and there were numerous batteries, and it was very well fortified. We had to have some support in landing. You couldn't just send infantry troops in because they would have got massacred before they ever got near the shore. So we had a Royal Marines gunships there. First time I'd known about them, actually, myself. And they used them to fire these small caliber guns, like maybe 25 pounds or 6 pounds or something like that, into the slots of the German positions, you know. And they did that very well, very successfully. They also had a couple of rocket craft. That was tank landing craft with rows and rows of rockets on them. Now, how effective they were, I wouldn't know. But they were fired at the approaches to the beachhead. Now, as for the individual troops, we travelled in tank landing craft. And inside a tank landing craft, because we expected the place to be full of water, and may have to cross water to get at our objectives, they had a new type of vehicle that was new to us until we started training with it at the Arm. We'd call a Buffalo, an American type of thing, which they used extensively in the Far East, actually. And that was it was like a big steel box with a driver cabin at one end, and it had tracks on it which were shaped not like tank tracks but more like S, with a type of S sort of bend in them where they gripped the water and they propelled the craft through water, so they were an amphibious vehicle. And the troops disembarked from the back of it rather than the front, which was added protection for them as they were getting out anyway, because you had this steel monster in front of you to protect you from certain amounts of small arms. They were the type of things that we were in. So when they were loaded on a tank landing craft, which is only an open deck, sunken deck, in the tank ship, tank landing craft type of ship, and these things came in, the troops had to stay in them, you know, get in them. And it was quite a long journey, and these things have no berths for troops anyway, and it was a bit of an arduous journey across the sea in these things. And when they approached the gap in the island where we were to land, I was sitting on the back end of this Buffalo inside the tank, and I could see across the top. And it was the first time I'd ever watched an approach right the way through, from the first time I could see it right until the actual time I got off and landed. And I saw these craft in and sinking on fire. And I thought, good Lord, we're going to have a tough time with this. Because they seem to be sinking them quite easily. Which they did. And then when the rockets fired, one of our own tank landing craft was immersed in the explosions. They fired them short. And the sea boiled in front of us. The rockets were absolutely useless, firing at that little narrow strip of ground. Either that or they were fired prematurely or something went wrong, but they certainly didn't hit the target. They nearly caused more casualties amongst us than they did to the Germans. Anyway, I was quite surprised that when we landed, I think 4-1 landed without a casualty. And this little place was boiling with fire. Because the Germans said it was the only place where we were obviously landing. And they concentrated all their guns on it. And they were firing at it willy-nilly. And, you know, it surprised me that we didn't have more casualties. But it was really quite an easy landing, I thought. But that's only my own personal landing. And why we were in these craft, these Buffaloes, defeats me. Because I think it only got out of the landing craft. And we got out of that. It was more of a hindrance. We'd have been better off running straight out of the landing craft. than getting out of two landing craft. This thing get lumbering out for a couple of yards, dropping it, because nowhere to go. There was just absolutely nowhere to go. It was just a big hole and the water on the other side. And my objective was a pillbox. And when I say pillbox, these weren't small things. Like you saw in Britain, about 5 feet square, with a little tiny slit in it. These were huge things. I could get all my men inside it without any problem, and we'd all be standing up, and we could all even go to sleep lying down, and they were that big, just the one room in these pillboxes. But as it had been delegated to me to knock it out, I went for it. I started off wading across the water, and Captain Stevens called me back. He said, "Nobody in there," he said. So we just accepted that redemption. And I joined him back on the road where the road was. And everything was flooded. And as we went in, I think, at low tide, you could see just the camber of the road, the top of the camber of the road, in the middle. And it was just, under a few inches of water. But as the camber fell away on either side towards the gutters, the edges of the road, of course, the water was deeper. And we started to walk up right through the middle of the road. Now, of course, being true British soldiers, we all fell in one behind the other. So if anybody had fired at us, we'd have been in a right silly position. We'd all been standing there. And he shot the first one. We'd all gone down like dominoes. But nobody thought about that, and we were heading up, and it seemed to be the only logical thing to do, seeing as everything else was full of water, and you couldn't see where you were walking. So we were sort of pinned to the middle of the road. And I think we were about halfway up, or possibly, no, must have been more than halfway up, two-thirds of the way up to this lighthouse, and we weren't running or anything like that. We were just walking at a steady pace. And out of the top window, I saw the movement, and I shouted the top window and fired at the same time. And there was a burst of fire came from the top window. And of all the people they shot was my mortar friend, the officer who was I just spoke about, outside Le Havre, who was showing me how to use the mortar. They shot him. Now, he was at the tail end, Charlie bit end of the troop, right at the back end, and they couldn't depress the gun enough without coming right into the window, which they wouldn't do. So they could only shoot down at an angle like that, and of course all the advancing troops were screened by their own building. But that, nevertheless, that didn't stop the troops from deploying. I suppose that it was laughable in retrospect, when you look at it. But most of my section immediately deployed when the firing came, and they ran for the houses and the cover of the houses on either side of the road. And they left Captain Stevens and myself standing in the middle, because we were still low to get our feet wet, being true British soldiers. And the others had disappeared, and there wasn't a sign of them, except the spluttering, and then they suddenly started appearing out of the water. And I didn't realise at the time, and it just struck me, why did they dive in the water? I thought they'd taken cover by just diving straight into the water, which hadn't been